Yes. Thank you very much for the invitation and for the introduction. So my research fields are evolutionary ecology and physiological ecology. And first of all, we all know, as Jenny also told us, that our environment is changing at faster rate than ever. And a key question in ecology and evolution is whether and how organisms may adapt to these fast changes. And to answer this question, we need to understand what are the underlying sources of variation in phenotypes. And by phenotypes, I mean morphology of organisms varies between individuals, behavior varies, and life history traits vary. And life history, for example, when do they reproduce, how many eggs they produce, what's the lifespan. And this influences their reproductive success and survival of the individuals, which is called fitness. So the sources of variation, traditionally, of course, variation is explained by genetic background and direct effect of the environment without a genetic change, which is phenotypic plasticity. And this phenotypic plasticity is considered to be one of the key mechanisms how organisms may adapt to these fast changes. But there's more mechanisms of variation, and one of them is non-genetic inheritance, which is a phenomenon where the environment of their parents influences how much, for example, resources they provide to the offspring, and then this influences the variation in phenotypes in offspring and may change them in such a way that they are better surviving in that environment. So non-genetic inheritance is another source of variation. And it's kind of a hot topic in evolutionary ecology to study whether it actually may allow adapting to this fast environmental changes. And that's one of my key interests as well. But to understand or predict how organisms adapt to fast changes, we need to understand the underlying physiological responses, because physiology is the key or the between environment and the phenotype. But understanding physiology also informs us about constraints. For example, when we produce energy, we simultaneously produce heat and harmful molecules, so energy production cannot be increased infinitely without a cost. And one more important aspect which links to Jenny's talk is microbiome. So that's all the microorganisms in the host. And this has been seen as also a key source of variation and potential for rapid adaptation. And I'll come to that later. So all in all, understanding the underlying sources of phenotypic variation can inform us or can help us to predict this how organisms may respond to environmental changes. That's very important. But there's other important points, which is it helps us to understand biodiversity in more general terms, and for example, to plan conservation actions. Or in more practical terms, understanding underlying sources of variation helps us to do decisions in agri and aquaculture on animal production. So my key interests are in understanding some unexplored mechanisms of variation and whether this links to adaptation. And these three areas are kind of my key research areas. So ecology and evolution of non-genetic inheritance, host microbiome research, and this physiological ecology. And they highly overlap. For example, microbes can be seen as a source of non-genetic inheritance because parents transfer them to the offspring. And then physiology is, it's very important to understand in terms of both host microbiome research and this non-genetic inheritance. In the middle, I have ecotoxicology, which is the research on how chemical pollutants influence organisms in wild populations. And why I put it in the middle is that any effects of these pollutants can be mediated via all these three pathways. So I'm an integrated biologist combining physiology, evolution, and ecology. And I'm using different methodologies, mostly in field populations, using experimental approaches and collecting long-term data, but also captive models. Most of my research has been on birds because they are very good study systems for my hypothesis. So I want to walk you through a little bit of my what I've done in the past and what I want to do here in Jyväskylä in the future. So in terms of physiological ecology, I think understanding the physiology of bioenergetics is very important because energy is basically, it's linked to everything in animal performance and potentially in the adaptations. And there are two aspects of bioenergetics which I think have been overlooked in especially in eco-evolution research. And one of them is mitochondria. And mitochondria are the energy-producing organelles in the cells. And for example, we recently found that there's large variation among individuals in mitochondria function. And mitochondria, they also respond to, for example, temperature variation and change with age. For example, here, in an experiment where we heated up nest boxes in a wild population of this gray tits, about 2 degrees, so it's like a mimicking climate change scenarios, we saw that the offspring from these heated boxes had higher mitochondrial density, potentially adaptive response to this changed temperature. But the key point is that we don't yet know what this variation means in terms of whether it influences life history traits or fitness, because most mitochondrial research is from biomedical fields at the moment. So there's a lot to do. And another key aspect of bioenergetics, which my group is working on, is thyroid hormone. So that's a hormone coordinating metabolism, growth, and thermoregulation. And it has been really neglected compared to, for example, stress hormone research, which is huge. And so we have developed, for example, methodology for measuring thyroid hormones in very small biological samples, which enables us to work on these topics in this eco-evolutionary framework. And for example, here we show that thyroid hormones are linked to life histories in birds. So this is a set of bird species, which are migratory, and these are non-migratory. And what we show here is that the migratory species have higher hormone levels, which we may explain as they have higher metabolic rates, and this is an adaptation to their long-distance flight. But as I said, we don't know too much about either of these yet. So in Jyväskylä, in my future, I would like to understand more on what are the environmental drivers of the two key physiological traits and how they link to phenotypes and potentially facilitate some adaptations. And here are some projects which actually I realized that they're all starting or studied this year with my group and my collaborators. So we work with different organisms, different systems. We study, for example, how temperature influences or salinity influences these physiological traits and how variation in these traits links to aging, growth, and animal performance within species. And then we also take a comparative approach. So we want to explore whether variation in these physiological traits relates to variation in life histories, especially lifespan across species in birds and in other vertebrates with my postdocs. And coming to the ecotoxicology side, which is a key part of my research, we started recently a project where we want to understand how hormones can be disrupted by environmental chemicals and whether this actually explains some recent declines that we see in ducks, in duck populations. And something else I want to do in the future is that I want to look more into this physiology as a constraint. For example, whether using artificial selection lines on, for example, thyroid hormones, whether there is a correlated change in other traits, so whether this constraint influences trait evolution adaptation. Yes, so this was about the physiology part, and I want to share something about this evolutionary ecology part. So most of the research into non-genetic inheritance has been on the mother's side, so maternal effects, meaning that how mothers influence offspring via resource transferring all kind of resources. And my group has also made some key progress here. So, for example, we have shown that these resources and hormones that the mothers transfer vary in response to many different environmental factors, such as climate, resource availability, predation risk, even the quality of the mate that the female mates with, and also pollution. For example, here we have an experiment where these sticklebacks were exposed to copper pollution, and then in their eggs they had higher thyroid hormone levels, which may then influence the develop of the offspring. We also showed that this transfer of these hormones and resources from the mother to the offspring via egg is there's a genetic component, so it's heritable, so it actually can this transfer itself can respond to, it can evolve and respond to selection. And a key point is that by manipulating these hormones, especially hormones in the eggs, we have shown that this variation in the hormones that the mothers transfer translates into variation in growth, in physiology, in behavior, and also up to survival. For example, here in this field population of collared flycatchers in Sweden, we showed experimentally that if they have higher testosterone levels in the eggs, the males survive worse, most likely to do some physiological costs. So in the future, we want to further, or actually currently we're having different experimental approaches to study whether this variation is actually adaptive. So we manipulate both the maternal side and the offspring environment and see whether the maternal transfer actually increases their fitness in the same environment. At the same time, we want to understand why do we find these long-term effects on for example, behavior. And one potential candidate is epigenetic regulation, so that these hormones influence, for example, the methylation marks in receptors of hormone receptors. And recently, we actually found that in this early life, adversity in terms of pollution does influence the epigenome in wild birds. So in the future, in Jyväskylä, I would like to go to the father side, which is much less studied. So fathers definitely influence their offspring also. And this can happen via non-genetic inheritance, by different molecules such as small RNAs via the sperm. But this is very little studied in, for example, in these bird systems. So this is one of my goals. And to understand, for example, how pollution exposure of the fathers may negatively influence the offspring via these paternal effects. And my colleague James has developed some methodology for this, and we are applying for funding. And in the future, like in a bigger picture, I want to understand how these maternal and paternal effects may contribute, like what's the relative contribution to the variation in offspring. Are there some conflicts or interactions? And finally, whether non-genetic inheritance actually help or hinder adaptation to these novel environments, because there's some recent critics on that it's not always helpful. And third research topic, which is also linked to non-genetic inheritance, is the microbiome research, which is a new field for me. But I guess you're all aware how important gut microbiome is for our own health, for example, metabolic rate, metabolism and immune function. And certainly it will be a revolutionary field in ecology and evolution to understand where does phenotypic variation actually originate. So how do microbes contribute to this variation? And actually microbes are considered such an integral part of the host that is called a unit, the holobiont. So we are talking about holobiont research. But we don't yet understand how important or which kind of traits the microbes may influence and how they might influence evolution and evolution, because most microbiome research up to now is from captive animals. And in captivity, the environmental changes and the kind of natural selection cannot be mimicked in captivity. So we need these wild microbiomes. And then coming back to the question like why or how microbes may adapt faster to the adapt the host faster to the new environment is that the reason is that reasoning is that because microbes evolve faster, so this may facilitate faster host adaptation. But that's just a hypothesis so far. And in, from the ecotoxicology point, actually, microbiome is becoming more and more important because it is also a target for pollutants. For example, we showed that the herbicide glyphosate influences gut microbiome in this quail model, especially so that in the young that were exposed to glyphosate, many bacteria, the group abundance of many bacteria groups was severely decreased compared to the controls. And this may have influenced the growth and physiology, which we also observed. So in the future, I want to, in Jyväskylä, I want to build a more comprehensive understanding on how microbiome may help to adapt to different environments. And here I'm again using this great system of gray tits. It's a bird species that is spread across Europe, so the populations are exposed to different temperatures, different day lengths. They also show differences in metabolic rates and reproduction, so phenotypic differences. But there's very little genetic differentiation. So then we ask the question whether this variation in microbiome could contribute to this variation across the populations. And to do this, we have to do lots of things. We first have to, what we want to do is to characterize the microbiome variation within among populations, whether there's genetic variation in it, and what are the environmental drivers of the variation using some experimental approaches, which we are doing at the moment. We want to characterize how microbes are transferred from parents to offspring. Importantly, we want to characterize how microbiome influences host reproductive success and survival, so whether there's selection on this microbiome, and what are the underlying physiological mechanisms which is influences. And in the local adaptation scenario, we want to understand whether a population with a certain microbiome performs better in that environment than if it would have another type of microbiome, basically. So we are doing microbiome transplants, hopefully, across populations. So this project is done. It already has funding from Aaltonen Foundation for the next 3 years, starting like this this autumn, and with a great team of collaborators which have all their different contributions. And with colleagues from Jyväskylä, Turku, and Helsinki, we are also planning on applying a center of excellence from Academy for this holobiont research. In the future, I would like to kind of replicate this kind of experiments in different systems to understand more about the real role of adaptation. But I'm also interested in going more to the ecotoxicology side to understand how different kind of environmental changes, like habitat, rapid habitat changes, may influence hosts via changes in the microbiome, and whether this may actually explain some population declines that we see. And from there, more evolutionary side, I want to understand what are the links between behavior and microbiome in wild populations, and even whether it influences my choice, so whether microbiome plays a role in sexual selection. So that was a summary of what I do and what I would like to do, and how my research then links to what is being done at the University of Jyväskylä. And I just draw some ideas bubbles here and there because I'm so interested and so excited to see all these collaborations. For example, I think that my interest in the host microbiome research would definitely overlap with the animal microbiome research that's being done here at the moment. But extending or including microbiome, for example, in some invasive species studies or host-parasite interactions, if you're not doing it yet, that would be a super great avenue. And in terms of this non-genetic inheritance, I also think that what I do complements, for example, the epigenetics research and transgenerational effects research here. And in terms of physiological ecology, I think I could have input, for example, in the species interaction studies or population ecology, to have this more integrated approach. And in terms of ecotoxicology, my expertise would fit, I think, with current what's being done here on, for example, metal toxicity or human-induced evolution studies, but bringing a terrestrial and a vertebrate system. All in all, I think the integrated approach that I use would be cool to link to many different aspects of the research that is being done here. And in terms of teaching, the integrated approach is also something that I want to promote there, so that students would have a comprehensive understanding from the molecular to the population level. And I think it could be achieved by explicitly integrating these links across courses. And if you're interested, it would be interesting, or it would be a possibility to build up, for example, a master's program on this integrated biology, because that's actually quite common in, for example, USA. And in my thinking about my contribution to teaching, I think evolutionary biology courses could be extended to have more on this non-genetic inheritance part. And the existing physiology course that you have could involve more on the ecophysiology side, and have I could have some lab training courses. And in the animal ethics course, I could bring this bird model system and training. And this host microbiome research of the holobiont could also be incorporated more into the evolutionary biology courses. And if we would happen to get the center of excellence, we could build a training network on this holobiont research. And as I said, for ecotoxicology, I could bring this terrestrial vertebrate model to the teaching as well. And I would be happy to teach, for example, behavioral ecology or evolutionary ecology and both fields in the lab. And one more thing before I finish, because I think the world is so competitive for the students now, so they need a lot of transferable skills. I saw from the curricula that you have good courses for this in master and bachelor student levels, but maybe emphasizing this more in the PhD student level to have like training on proper training on data and project management would be really great. And if you don't have one, I would also like to set up a mentoring program for PhD postdocs, because we have this in Turku and it worked really nicely. So finally, thank you very much, and I want to thank all my collaborators and colleagues and all the funding. Yes. Yay.
Thank you very much. Very nice talk. The floor is open for questions. Comments. There.
I have a very technical question about the microbiome transplantation. What kind of permits do you need? Are you going to do it across different countries or within the population?
So what we plan to do at the moment and what we are applying the licenses is, because Finland is already very large, or we have very big differences, so the idea is to sample across Europe, but then use Finland as the kind of receiving populations, like two Finnish populations. One would be in the Kevo research station up north, and one would be more in the southern side. And it depends a bit, like according to the authorities, if there's, for example, no avian influenza in these areas where these samples come from, it's probably not a problem for them. But we have to be aware of what is the situation in the countries that we collect the samples. And it may be that we have to do it in outdoor aviaries, so that we can't do it really in the wild, but we have outdoor aviaries if there would be a disease, some kind of spread, so it's controlled. But then they would still have the same, especially the important is to have the same circadian rhythm temperature still.
So mm-hmm. You mentioned that this kind of epigenetic changes could either facilitate or hinder adaptation. So mm-hmm. Can you give an example how it actually could hinder adaptation?
Yeah. If this, let's say, maternal effects are in a sense predictive, so that there's a cue which the mother perceives, which really leads to a certain type of epigenetic change or allocation resources or so on. But if the cue changes, so they're not responding what they should be responding to, and that's like where the mismatch comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your hypothesis of that hormones, tyrosine specifically, could drive the life history.
Yep, yep.
Why not other way around? And does it matter?
Yeah, it's a very good question because, of course, like when we're using correlative data, like comparative, we can't say one way or the other, actually. But why we think that the thyroid hormones are driving life history differences is that because they are like pace of life syndrome, basically. So metabolic rates is seem to or is considered to affect whether an individual has a very fast life history or very slow life history, for example, whether they have a short lifespan or long lifespan. And then that thyroid hormones would be linked to that, regulating the metabolic rates. That's basically the idea around it. Well, at the moment, we are concentrated on a stress receptor. So, for example, in one of the experiments that we had, we manipulated the prenatal stress hormones, so basically injecting stress hormones into the eggs. And then we wanted to understand whether this leads to differential methylation in the stress receptor. So now we are looking at the stress receptor gene and its methylation. But for this pollution experiment, or where we wanted to look how pollution may influence organisms via epigenetic changes, so that was RIBS. So we didn't have any candidates, so we just screened things there. And then we found one of the most important ones was this, can't remember all the numbers, but IGF. But basically it's a gene that regulates embryonic development and growth. And that was one of the... which the methylation was most affected. And we also saw that in these individuals that were exposed to this pollution, the growth rates were slower. So maybe it makes a sense.
Okay, last question. Thanks. I have this issue that we study a microbiome or mitochondria or telomeres. Do you know that you're studying the most important? Vertebrate and say the mitochondria, so the tissues differ. How do you know that these are representative samples of the most important tissues or subsets of something that we're studying?
Yeah, especially for the mitochondria, it's tricky because what we do at the moment is that because it's wild animals and we take blood samples. In birds, it's amazing because they have functional mitochondria in their red blood cells. So we can actually measure the mitochondrial function without, for example, doing a muscle biopsy or killing the animal. But yes, we know that this mitochondrial activity in the red blood cells is correlated with the mitochondrial activity in the muscles. So there's this kind of suggests that we could use it as a proxy. But of course, this correlation, it's not very strong. And definitely, if you think of... Well, this is for movement. If it's muscles, but for something else, then we need another tissue, like the brain tissue or something. Yeah, I totally agree that we are limited by what we can measure and how it relates to the performance of the animal, really. And it's the same for microbiome. So because we sample fecal samples and how representative they are, from different parts of the gut where everything is going on. Yep.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.